Okay, so here we go. Green for all, no really everybody. I'm Anna Deavere Smith, and I'm sitting here with Van Jones and Majora Carter. You have their bios in your program, and some of you heard Majora this afternoon at lunchtime, but I'm just going to give a brief introduction about both of them, and then we'll jump right into it. Van Jones is the founder and president of Green for All, based in Oakland, California. The mission is to help build an inclusive green economy, strong enough to lift millions of people out of poverty. Van is a tireless advocate championing green-collar jobs and opportunities for disadvantaged people. He is committed to creating green pathways out of poverty while greatly expanding the coalition fighting global warming. Van has worked to combine solutions to America's two biggest problems, social inequality and environmental destruction. Under the slogan, Green Collar Jobs, Not Jails, he's calling for green economic development in urban America. In 2007, Van helped the City of Oakland pass a Green Jobs Corps proposal. The city allocated funds to train Oakland residents in eco-friendly green collar jobs. In 2005, he produced the social equity track for the United Nations World Environment Day celebration. It drew dozens of mayors from around the world to San Francisco, where they developed policies promoting the concept of green cities. In 1996, he co-founded the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights with Diana Frappier, located in Oakland, California. Named for an unsung civil rights heroine, the award-winning center promotes alternatives to violence and incarceration. In 1993, Yale Law School graduate, Van is also husband and father. He is proud to champion some of the most hopeful solutions to America's toughest challenges. Thank you. Majora Carter was born, raised, and continues to work and live in the South Bronx, but her career takes her around the world in pursuit of resources and ideas to improve the quality of life in her environmentally challenged community. She founded Sustainable South Bronx in 2001 after working with other local groups, where she wrote a $1.25 million federal transportation grant to design the South Bronx Greenway with 11 miles of bike and pedestrian paths, connecting the rivers and neighborhoods to each other and to the rest of the city. That project secured over $20 million in funds to begin construction in 2008. She has been instrumental in creating riverfront parks, building green roofs, working to remove the Sheridan Expressway in favor of positive economic development, and successfully implemented BEST, Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training Program, a pioneering green-collar job training and placement system, seeding her community with a skilled workforce that has both a personal and economic stake in their urban environment. These accomplishments grow from her notion that self-image is influenced by surroundings, so those surroundings should be beautiful. Her vision, drive, and tenacity earned her a MacArthur Genius Grant. She started 2007 as one of Newsweek's 25 to watch, ended the year as one of Essence Magazine's 25 most influential African Americans, named one of the 50 most influential women in New York City by the New York Post for the past 2 years, and New York City's most influential environmentalists by the BBC World Service. Please welcome Majora Carter and Van Jones to our community. So we just heard a very powerful talk and almost indictment of our moment. One of my favorite lines in Tom Friedman's talk was about America getting its groove back. How do you think America can get its groove back?
And we are the two people to tell you this. It is so exciting to be here, I mean, especially here with Van, because here we are. I mean, I'm sorry, I was just sitting there listening, you know, to Tom Friedman and Sadine Kamen earlier and thinking there is a lot of hope out there. And we're calling it the green economy. And, you know, I started doing this work about 7 years ago, and just in a small way showing that there would be possibilities that if you treated people, if you worked to restore their dignity and our understanding and making the world a better place, like starting in the communities that they lived in, if you trained them to be a part of that environmental restoration, and then so they understood that their economics were tied up into it as well, that would be a way to help propel people to be a part of the environmental change that we needed to happen. And so we did that in a very small, small way, you know, in the South Bronx. And what Van and I are working on doing now is how do we, you know, take that and ramp that up into the kind of level that actually provides even more of that for more and more people of all colors all over this country. And so we're calling it Green for All, and Van's going to talk a lot more about it later. But the whole idea is that we want to use the green economy to create pathways for people out of poverty so that we're alleviating poverty and also providing opportunities to restore the environment, because we are going to need everyone involved in order to make that happen. It's not just going to be an only top-down thing. Believe me, we need the top-down. We need the support, you know, from the federal government, et cetera, but we also are going to need support, you know, with people understanding that they're a part of the solution and not only the problems as well.
How about it? How's America going to get its groove back?
Well, first of all, I just think we should give another round of applause to Tom Friedman. I thought that was an extraordinary, extraordinary presentation of the challenges that we face. I think, you know, all of us who are still here, I know y'all hot. It's not as crowded, it's not as flat, but I think the title fits the scene as well. I want to say a couple of things. First of all, I'm so proud to be here with Majora. The courage of Tom's vision and his words is matched by the courage of Majora's vision and her deeds in actually trying to make the green transformation happen where it's hard. The reality is, when you think about what Tom Friedman says has to happen, you get excited. You also get intimidated. You listen to some of the candidates talk, you get excited, but you also, when they get finished talking, you feel stuck. And the reason is, we haven't figured out the politics of the Green Revolution. At this point, it's no longer, as Dean Kamen points out, a technological problem. It's no longer even an economic problem. The economic argument has been made. The question is, how do we build a politics that matches the moment? Our argument is very straightforward. We have to radically expand the coalition that's moving to solve the climate crisis. And there is only one way to expand that coalition. And that is to expand the number of people who will benefit from the transition. The challenge that we have right now is that we have to fight pollution and poverty at the same time. The eco-elite, of which I'm a part, those of us who have good degrees and can afford to pay that green premium for the organic tofu and all those good things, we're too small. The green economy can no longer just be a place where affluent people spend money. In order for us to expand this coalition, it has to become a place where ordinary people can earn money, you see. It has to become a place where ordinary people can earn money. If we're going to beat global warming, we're going to have to weatherize millions and millions of buildings so they don't leak so much energy. That's thousands of contracts, millions of jobs, billions of dollars of economic stimulation. If we're going to beat global warming using technologies we have right now, we're going to have to put up millions of solar panels all across the country, thousands of jobs, thousands of contracts, millions of jobs, billions of dollars of economic stimulation. That is an argument you can take out to a country that's hurting economically. We can say to the country, we want to grow the economy. We want to put your kids to work. We want to see people with green hard hats and tool belts and work boots putting up, retrofitting a nation. That's the challenge, to retrofit, reboot, re-energize a nation. We have all these people who are in the South Bronx, who are in Oakland, California, who need work. We have all this work that needs to be done. The challenge is to connect the people who most need work with the work that most needs to be done, to fight pollution and poverty at the same time, to end forever the need for oil wars and resource wars and bring this country together. That is a political challenge. And if we can meet that political challenge, I think we have a chance.
This afternoon at lunch, Majora, you gave the example of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that?
I think the challenge that we are facing right now environmentally in terms of climate change, pollution, environmental degradation, et cetera, you know, is the kind of challenge that could either, one, you know, make us all stick our heads in the ground and just wish it never happened, or it could have the kind of galvanizing influence that World War II actually did have on an entire nation. The example that I used today was that, you know, here was my dad, you know, born and raised in the rural South, still was willing and happy to fight and die, you know, for his country during World War II, simply because he was interested and excited about the promise of America. We are standing on that same ground right now. What is the promise of America that we could either decide that we're going to just, you know, go down in a sinking ship, you know, as sea levels rise, or we're going to use this as an opportunity to create great opportunities for people to be a part of the new green economy. It is about creating a new green deal. You know, when I think about, you know, the fact that Roosevelt didn't ask, you know, the automakers during World War II to, like, would you mind kind of stop making cars right now and maybe take 10 years or so to do it? No, he said, you've got 4 months to start making tanks so that we can fight fascism in a way that we know how. You know, he told women, everybody knew, they had to ration food for their families. No more silk stockings, none of that stuff. But, you know, men who could have been lynched in their own hometowns were suddenly willing to fight and die for this country. And those, if that is real, then everybody was willing to do that. And I think that if we, the same way that we put it out there back then, that this, that we're not fighting just against fascism, that we are fighting for a future that we can all be proud of, then I doubt that anybody will say, well, I'm not going to do it because I'm not sure what's in it for me. You'll know what's in it for you. And I think that's what the hope that I have, that we have right now is going
forward. Well, talk about some of the challenges that you face in your community. I mean, what about, how do you think about responsibility? How do you think about the responsibility of the people who you actually work with every day? First, why don't you, Majora, and then we'll go.
I think many of our communities, I don't care what color they are, if they've been left out, you know, or disenfranchised in any way, what color, doesn't matter, their tendency is to feel powerless and to feel as though there isn't much that they can contribute. But the second that they know that they can actually play a role, that their actions can have far-ranging impacts, far beyond, you know, just their little world right here, then they start acting accordingly. And I know I've seen it, you know, in terms of the ecological restoration job training program that we run, you know, where we, you know, worked with folks who've never had a job before. We work with folks, many of whom have been incarcerated. And when they start to understand the tools and the developments of how to do ecological restoration, and we're training them to start doing solar installations and also even building retrofits sooner, they start to understand that the power in their hands, that the work that they're doing is actually doing something that is far beyond anything that most of society teaches, you know, that young, poor people of color or otherwise can actually bring about to humanity. Once they start to realize that, then they start to take on a sense of responsibility for their own futures.
Just say how much it costs to train per person.
Our program is about $7,000 per person for a 10-week program that includes skills in ecological restoration, wetland restoration, remediating brownfields, of course the soft skills of learning actually how to become, you know, a great employee. Even sooner or later we're going to be doing entrepreneurial development for people who want to start their own businesses as well.
And you said you have like an 85%
success rate. Most job training programs in this country are pretty happy if they have about a 50% success rate. You know, there's all sorts of programs where they will train people for jobs that they know do not even exist. You know, right now we're looking at how do you create new markets? How we're working on developing regulations as well and actually supporting legislation that would actually help build the market for things like green roof installation, for building retrofits, so that we are going to be ahead of the game and having trained people who can go and do this work going forward. And it's not just happening in the South Bronx. I mean, the whole idea is that this is the kind of kernel of, you know, a nugget that is supposed to grow and develop into the kind of economy that is going to help lift all boats.
You know, you've talked also very humorously, Van, about what it means to bring a crisis to black folks, and I don't know if the sentence actually goes together this way, but to knock on Pookie's door and tell her that the polar bears are in trouble, she may or may not be interested. Maybe you should say who Pookie is. I don't know if the whole audience knows, and what that means to, in effect, be a kind of a translator of the problem and to find the place that entry can be.
Well, first of all, I'm sitting here looking at one of my great heroes, Mayor Cory Booker, who you should give a round of applause to, one of the green mayors in urban America right now. Wave your hand, brothers, they can see you. He's doing it for real, on a real basis. You know, when you take a mayor like this, African-American mayor, went to Yale, Rhodes Scholar, the whole deal, goes back to Newark, goes to Newark to try to turn that city around. And you want to have a conversation with people about some of these big ideas here at the Idea Festival. It's very difficult to start out, as Tom told the world in its column, but I've said a million times, you can't go down the street in Newark or Watts or South Bronx and knock on the door. Open the door! It's an emergency, open up! You know, grandma, baby, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's happening? What's going on? Oh, it's terrible. What is it? Did somebody get shot? Oh, no, no. We got to do something. Oh, what do we got to do? We got to do something about the polar bears. The polar bears are drowning. We got to help them. Now, you may not make it out of the neighborhood alive with that. I'm just telling you. And why? Is it because the polar bears aren't important? No, it's not. If they go, we're next. And that's just if you're greedy and selfish, you put it that way, right? If the polar bear goes and I'm next, so I care about the polar bear because I care about myself. But it's deeper than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're beautiful beings. They were here before we got here. Some of these beings that are going extinct, they have a right to be here. We have no right to push them into extinction. So we're right to raise the alarm. But the problem is that when that door opens, you're talking to somebody whose child is drowning on dry land, whose child may be going to a school with 29, 32, 36 kids in a classroom, 6 books, no chalk, no toilet paper. If the child gets upset or frustrated, gets into a push and shove in the hallway, they don't go to the principal's office anymore. They'll go to the precinct in handcuffs. In California, that's called a strike. And in the police car, there might be better computers in the police car than the classroom they just left. The adults, when they get to the juvenile detention center, make $20,000, $30,000 more than the teacher. So when you're talking to grandmama about the polar bear, she's thinking about Pookie. Pookie, Ray Ray, Josue, Shaniqua. And she's wondering, she's looking at you, she's saying, I get why you care about the world, but do you care about my child? In your green economy, you don't have any throwaway resources. You don't have any throwaway species. Do you have throwaway children? Are we going to have throwaway neighborhoods? Is the green economy about just reclaiming, throwing away stuff?
Well, what is there? Do we dare think that there's even a moral argument here about a throwaway culture that throws away children? And we talk about that in a lot of different ways here in Aspen, the throwaway child.
What I'm trying to say is that if we're going to build a green economy, it shouldn't just be based on reclaiming, throwing away stuff. That's important. In fact, I'd rather for us to reclaim throwing away stuff, because then you can have two factories, one factory putting stuff together, The other battery taking stuff apart. Twice as many jobs. But I would also like for us to say that it's a moral question. We don't have any throwaway children or neighborhoods either. It's all precious. We want this green wave to lift all boats.
And I think both of you also see this as an economic opportunity that you don't want to miss. You've talked about how, in many ways, African Americans missed out on the IT revolution, right? So I think a part of what you're trying to do is to make sure that we are a part of this new economy, or we are part of these new opportunities that Tom Friedman is talking about when he speaks to us powerfully about he who writes the rules. You want to say something about that?
Yes, I mean, we did completely, like, you know, when the IT boom went bust, you know, people in poor communities, we didn't notice, gotta tell you. And that was most people around the world. But this time around, you know, this is the kind of thing where we are actually needed in order to make a real dent in what's gonna happen. And the other thing that I think is so important here, you know, is the fact that I don't, and this may seem really awful, but the bottom line is, like, I think as we, you know, the fact is that we are going to see more green prisons built in this country before we see many green schools built. We are setting up, I mean, we know that poverty in and of itself is something that breeds more American forms of terrorism than anything else. If you have nothing to look forward to, nothing to gain, and much of that comes with the fact, understanding the knowledge that your economics, I mean, there was a reason why Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about economic justice at the end of his life just as much as he was about racial justice, because he knew good and daggone well was that if you give a black man his freedom and he does not have a job in order to support his family, to create the kind of stability in their communities, then he doesn't have that much. And so they're all tied together. And people that are really desperate, in desperate situations, I don't care if it's the Middle East or I don't care if it's here, the bottom line is what you will get is a country that it will be a tinderbox. And on so many levels, we're watching this country get hotter in more ways than one. And that's why it's so important to know that the same people that have been thrown away for such a long time, you know, in our society, can actually become the heroes of the future if we give them an opportunity to do so.
You've used the expression the dignity of work, and you think about these green heroes in your community. Talk about the dignity of work.
Sure. Well, part of the opportunity that we have is to think about the dignity of labor. We've almost gotten to the point where if you try to introduce the idea that we can train a whole new generation of what we call green-collar workers, and we used to have blue-collar pathways out of poverty, we now expect our young people to climb a six-story ladder out of poverty, but the ladder only has four rungs on it. So it's not possible. What we're saying is with a greening of the country, we can start to put some of those basic stair steps back in there. Let our young people have the dignity of being not seen as a social villain, but the ecological hero, the ecological shero. That's really important. We can't drill and burn our way out of our economic and energy crisis. This is really critical that we understand that. We can't drill and burn our way out. If we do, we'll bake the planet. But we can invent and invest our way out. And if we choose to, as Tom Friedman says, invent and invest our way out, and add one more I, invent, invest, and include. Invent, invest, and include. We can solve our social problems and our environmental problems. I think it's so
What inhibits the inclusion?
Let me just finish my thought. The reason I think it's important to say that is because it's been 40 years since Bobby Kennedy was shot 40 years ago this summer. Dr. King was shot 40 years ago this year. The pain and the heartbreak is still in the country. I was born that year. Dr. King was 39 when he got shot. I'm 39 right now. He never got to be 40. We act like he was 70. He never saw his 40th birthday. If Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy were here today, they would say about this green economy. They would be proud that we are beginning to make these changes. But they would ask a question. And the question they would ask, they would say, where is the bull Connor that's preventing us from creating this green economy in a more inclusive way? Where are the attack dogs? Where are the fire hoses? They would talk to the white leaders, the black leaders, the Latino leaders, the Asian leaders, the green leaders. And they would say, you have an opportunity now to reinvent the economy, to reboot it, to retrofit it. You get to break up with oil. That's a tremendous opportunity. Well, go ahead and break up with classism and racism and sexism too. Go ahead and do it the right way. Because if you do it the right way, you will unleash the energy and the imagination and the creativity of the whole people. And that is the only thing. You mentioned, Tom Friedman mentioned, and then I'll be quiet, but you mentioned Noah. And I think that's a powerful metaphor. I think about the Titanic as another metaphor.
Well, you say you go from Amistad to Titanic.
Well, sure, sure. When I was doing politics, back when Corey knew me, when I was young and radical, I thought of the politics I was doing as the Amistad politics. People may not know the Amistad was a slave ship, and there was a slave rebellion, and the leader Senkyu got the ship turned back toward freedom. And I thought that was me. I'm going to free my people, and we're going to head toward freedom. And I spent 20 years of my life leading the Amistad Rebellion. We black people are going to rise up, and we're going to be free. And then I looked outside of the boat, and the boat wasn't called Amistad. It was called the Titanic. And then my leadership challenge changed quite a bit. I got to save my people, but also got to help save everybody else and help save the ship. And now it's more urgent that we save the people on the bottom of the boat. Maybe if they had let the people at the bottom of the Titanic be involved with the solution, they'd have come up with a better solution. So now the challenge is to free the people, to unleash their creativity, to help save the whole boat. And I think that's the politics. You say, how we get our groove back? That's the politics. It's the politics of bringing everybody's genius into play to solve everybody's shared problem.
What inhibits the inclusion do you find on a daily basis?
And some of it definitely has to do with the way that mainstream environmentalism is sort of structured.
Say that again a little bit louder.
The way that mainstream environmentalism is structured, it is incredibly white, and I think on some, and pretty middle class, and I don't think that many people see themselves tied up in that. I mean, I gotta tell you, I think in many ways, the work that I do isn't often considered environmentalism, to tell you the truth, because it's a piece that works predominantly, you know, in urban environments, et cetera. So that is definitely, you know, the coming together, you know, of understanding that we're all part of one environmental movement as opposed to there being, like, different segmented parts would be helpful. And I think that also sort of speaks to the other piece that, you know, people want to see, you know, how they are reflected in it as well. So that's one of those are just two of the ways to do that as well. And I think just people understanding just how much power they actually have in terms of being a part of the way things can change. That's why the work that Van and I and other folks around the country are doing is so important, because we're absolutely trying to empower folks to understand that they are.
Well, you were empowered when you went back to the Bronx, right?
Eventually, you know, it took me a long time to want to be there.
But you reacted to a very sensory thing.
Very much so.
Why don't you just say a few words about that?
I grew up when the South Bronx was literally the poster child for urban blight, and did my best to leave, only came back home because I was broken, had to live with my parents. And when I got there, one thing that really did kind of change the way that I saw everything, because I really thought that people in my own community were to blame for much of the environmental degradation that they experienced, you know, because if they really cared, you know, then it wouldn't be so bad. But it wasn't true. Our community, because it was poor and of color, was used as the repository for a lot of really noxious facilities because it was politically expedient to do so. You know, laws were not changed, even though they knew the impact that it had on people, public health-wise and otherwise. And when I got a thorough understanding of that, that's when I realized, you know what? It has very little to do with, you know, my next door neighbor, Jose, you know, or the people across the street. This has everything to do with a political process that allowed all of this to happen on the backs of a very poor, politically vulnerable community. And I wanted to be a part of the change.
I see, a change agent. So one last question for both of you. We're in a movement, and it requires great language and oratorical skills. We've heard some from Tom Friedman. We've heard some from you. I've read things that both of you have written. And I think many of us are concerned about how we can use language in influential ways. What kinds of words work and resound in the Green and Black movement for you? What kinds of words work and resound in the Green for All movement for you?
Oh, gosh. You go first.
Well, first of all, I think that we are, I think words do matter. I think that we are now trying to articulate a new kind of environmentalism. I sometimes use the term social uplift environmentalism, or eco-populism. The idea that you can solve problems, that you can use the ecological solutions to solve social problems and vice versa. But I think the main change that I think has to happen is that we sometimes talk about top-down solutions. We want the federal government to do more, the Green New Deal. Some people have said the Green Manhattan Project, the Green Apollo Project. The federal government has to get involved. We sometimes talk about the bottom-up solutions as well in terms of what people are doing at the community level. But I think the real change is going to be top down, bottom up, but mainly inside out. This is mainly going to be an inside out change. It's going to be, the words will resonate because they come from a different place inside of us. And my belief about where all these roads converge, all the different dynamics that Tom was talking about, where they lead us is the movement we've always wanted. Since Bobby and Martin were killed, there's been a hole in the country. We've tried different things. But I think the movement that we've always wanted was all colors, all classes, the best of our scientists, the best of our business community, best of labor, best of civil rights, best of environmentalists, working together to get us the country we've always wanted. A world leader. But not a world leader in war, or pollution, or incarceration rates. A world leader in clean, green technology, in showing a rainbow, multicultural, multi-faith world, how a rainbow, multicultural, multi-faith country came together to solve the biggest problem ever. That's who I think we're trying to be. And different people will say it different ways. But I believe that we're at a place now where we can do a lot more than just take America back. I keep hearing these politics, take America back. I think we now are at a place where we can take America forward for the first time in 40 years.
And the lady gets the last word.
A couple short ones. Green our ghettos. Because if you deal with those... Number one, you are dealing with point sources for so much of our environmental degradation. And I'm talking the ghettos of the South Bronx as much as I'm talking the ghettos of coal country. Yes, you were talking to looking at a black chick, you know, from an inner city ghetto, talking and being in solidarity with my brothers and sisters, you know, in coal country and around the country in places like that. And the other one, I have to quote Jay, or paraphrase it, because I don't know the exact line, but at the risk of sounding ridiculous, the root of all this is love.
Thank you so much, Van Jones and Majora Carter.